The person will not allow you to go back on there. So if you make your routine inspection, which or investigation of a fire, and you find some cause for arson, and it would be a lot of this occurs at night, and should you leave and come back, then that person has the right to refuse you entry to that property.
Okay. I guess, if I may, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. Have you folks been having real problems out there? You or your assistants? I guess your assistants includes anybody basically at the local level who may be operating in terms of a supervisory capacity at fire suppression. Have you been encountering problems out there? Or?
We've had several incidents where it's been people that's involved with fire scene situations, suspicion of arson, where they have had to come back for whatever reason and get permission to get back on the property. And there's some confusion with the judges and the people issuing these administrative warrants. We haven't had a tremendous amount of situations like this. No.
Mr. Chairman, sir, you just, I'm reading the opinion here from the AG's office, and it says, fire inspections conducted immediately following a fire in order to learn the cause of the blaze are recognized by both Oregon and federal courts as exceptions to the general rule that either search warrants or consents are required for fire inspections.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need a warrant in those circumstances?
Right, that's correct.
Okay, so it would be for the warrant, an inspection where there was no fire, the administrative inspection.
Well, if we went and asked the owner of a, let's say, a restaurant, a routine inspection that we needed to inspect his property, and he said no, then we would have to get an administrative warrant to get on the property. Mm-hmm. We have already went through this process, and the problem is that some of the judges get them confused with criminal warrants. We're not after a criminal warrant. There's no cause beyond the fact that we are inspecting to ascertain that there are not any fire hazards on that property.
One more question. Do you currently have administrative standards of your own for when conducting a routine periodic inspection?
Yes, we have. Are you saying, do we go out? Do we have a list of facilities that we inspect? Is that what you're saying?
I guess I'm saying, do you have a guidelines as to what you inspect and how you inspect it?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Representative Springer?
Well, I guess I'm still trying to wrestle with this. It seems to me you've got two different situations. You've got the administrative inspections, and you've got the inspections that occur after there's been a fire where you're looking to determine the cause of the fire, arguably. And one of the circumstances may be that it's been deliberately caused, which would be, your investigation would be tantamount to the investigation of a crime. It seems to me you got at least three distinct circumstances there. You've got the routine administrative examination of premises, I guess, for fire hazards, kind of a safety check, most times with the consent of the owner of the premises. Then you've got the inspection that you do, I guess, routinely after any fire, whether you suspect arson or not.
Yes.
And then I guess you've got a more specific subset of that is the kind of investigation that you would conduct if you suspected arson. In other words, you're engaged in an investigation which is focused upon the possibility or probability that a criminal act has taken place. And that's quite different from, you know, the first two categories. And it doesn't seem that the bill, as it's drafted, kind of distinguishes how the law or how the courts treat each of those distinct circumstances.
We do not become involved with the last category at all.
You do not?
No. We have no police authorities. We cannot investigate an arson fire. We are under law required to find the cause of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all. But I guess I confuse you by saying that the reason that they probably would not let you in is because they have something to do with the fire. But that has nothing to do with us, only from the standpoint that if we went to a fire and we had not completed our probable cause of the fire, then we would have to go back to determine that. If at the point that we even suspect that it's arson, we turn it over to the State Police Arson Division. And they, of course, can get criminal warrants or whatever they need.
Okay, I guess we could go.
Yeah, I think they're calling roll on the floor, so we're going to have to go down on this. I noticed that it might be useful if you could contact the Attorney General's office again and see if they feel there's still some, you know, someone to come over to address this with us. Either I think we've got this scheduled for a work session already in about...
It's a borrowed bill.
It's a borrowed bill, so we've got 10 days to hear on it. It might be useful if you would... we'll make a contact also and see if somebody wants to come over and talk to us about that from the AG's office, what the current status is. I noticed that at the time this was written, Stanton Long was the Deputy Attorney General, and he's now the head of the Department of Commerce, so he's in the same building. Maybe you can ask him about that.
You would like us to contact the AG's office and have somebody contact you on this?
Yeah, they'd either come to the work session and let us know what their status is.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We'll try to take another recess. We have one last bill to have a hearing on, and then we have a work session on some bills. This is a hearing on House Bill 2725. Mr. Jacobson, or whomever's. It's been a long day for everyone.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Hertzmark, representing the Metropolitan Public Defenders. Mr. Jacobson is unable to remain until you return. We did distribute some information to you, some testimony concerning this bill. I'll go through it as best I can. I'm not the expert on it. And hopefully if you have any questions, I'll be able to get those questions to Mr. Jacobson and have some answers for you if you have any. What our basic concern with 2725 is that it's making it much more difficult to have a constitutional law on the books. The bill attempts to condition the admission of a defense expert testimony at the sentencing hearing regarding a dangerous offender status. And it's conditioning it on the defendant's submission to a state-ordered psychiatric examination. If this bill was to become law, it would basically violate the defendant's right to compulsory process under the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. And also under the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 11. There is a United States Supreme Court case, which is cited in the information that was handed out to you, of Estelle versus Smith, where a similar issue was raised. In that case, a state psychiatrist examined the defendant and testified at the penalty phase of the trial as to the defendant's dangerousness. The state argued that the defendant's right against self-incrimination did not apply since the guilt had already been established. The Supreme Court rejected that concept, and we think that would also stand for the bill as it's written now. There's also a Oregon case, which is State versus Huntley, which is cited on page 2 of the materials. In that case, um, the bill would have denied the defendant an equal right to present such expert testimony. And it would have violated a constitutional right to present evidence protected by the compulsory process clauses. And we would just like to urge that the committee table the bill.
Okay. Are there questions? You don't happen to know who sponsored this bill in the first place? I think it came from the committee, but I'm...
No, we don't. We're hoping
here,
you knew.
Anybody here speaking to this bill? Anybody else? Okay. Any questions? Thanks, Marcy.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else to be heard on 2725? Well, we'll close the hearing on that. Move to a work session.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. House Bill 2540. We have a hearing on 2540, which you've all been waiting patiently for. So let me back up. And okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Norris, and I'm the owner of the 4J's Incorporated in Newport, Oregon, which operates three restaurants on the coast of Oregon. However, I'm here today as a board member and representative of the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association, which I think you're fairly well familiar with, and what it represents, a trade association of restaurants, taverns, hotels, resorts, and food and beverage suppliers. I apologize for having to keep coming back. This is the third legislative session in a row that we've come back with the same bill, but the reason we're back is because the problem still exists, and so we're hoping that maybe we can convince someone that there is a solution to this. We urge your adoption of 2540, House Bill 2540, and the attached amendments, which would tighten the social gaming statute by requiring cities and counties that allow social games to regulate the rules those games are played by and to license those individuals who operate those games. By doing so, we would be able to ensure that these games in fact remain social as they were originally intended by the legislature when it was passed back in the early 70s. The concept addressed in HB 2540 is not new to the legislative arena. This is just a little history, if you'll pardon me here, but I think it's appropriate to go back to see what happened. It was introduced in 1983 as Senate Bill 573 at the request of several cities. It was intended to facilitate the regulation of social games. Copies of correspondence from Attorney John Tuthill and the cities of Rockaway and Tillamook for further background on the nature of the problem, I believe you have. At that time, local ordinances which placed local regulatory controls on social gambling, including the licensing of the dealers, were ruled unlawful by the Attorney General. And that's where the problem came in. So Senate Bill 573 was approved by the legislature, but vetoed by the governor due to concerns raised by the Attorney General and some district attorneys. The Attorney General recognized that the proposal 573 addressed serious problems in the current law relating to vague language and uneven enforcement, which deserve legislative attention and would help address the problem of dealer cheating by card mechanics and would provide the owner-manager with a desirable greater control over social games. However, the Attorney General, Mr. Frohnmayer, recommended a veto, and you have a copy of the letter, to allow comprehensive review of the deep-seated problems that existed. One of the Attorney General's concerns regarded the lack of any standards in the measure for local governments to use in the regulation of social games. Our amendments try to address these minimum standards, including size of bets, rotation of deal, licensing requirements, and appropriate fees so that the licensing program will be self-supporting. These amendments were drafted by our association's legal counsel in conjunction with conversations that our executive director, Mr. Cross, and representatives of the Attorney General's office had during the 1985 session when this issue was reintroduced as House Bill 2881. However, the governor nor the Attorney General would endorse the amendments, and so the bill died in committee, as many presumed the governor would veto it again. With a new governor in office, we believe that the proposal merits your favorable attention once again. Now, in order to address these amendments that we've asked for, they're outlined as follows. The amendments would establish one criteria for establishments to employ and local governments to license social game managers, social game managers, who would enforce the rules of the game but would be prohibited from playing in these games. In other words, they could have nothing to do with banking the games, but they would be merely sit down and monitor the games. Two, provisions limiting the income of a social game manager could receive, that the social game manager could receive, to moderate gratuities from the players, tips, and or employment income from the business operator. But financial participation in the games themselves would be prohibited. Three, it would impose limits on the number of games per business. Now, your amendments, I think, address that. It would put betting limits in. Betting limits to keep it so it wouldn't be attractive to the so-called outside interests of $5. Rules on the rotation of deals. Six, authorization for local governments to assess licensing fees for the playing of social games and the licensing of social game managers. And seven, provisions allowing businesses to charge a reasonable fee to social game managers and or players for the use of the table, cards, and tokens used in the operations of social games. The adoption of these amendments would help local governments, law enforcement agencies, and the business operators to provide better local control and enforcement of social gaming by keeping the stakes low, and it should discourage the card mechanics from participating so that games will remain social and not become prey to no-holds-barred gamblers and elements of organized crime. This next paragraph merely says that they proved to be an important feature in many communities and tourism activities, and I think that goes without saying. People like to do this. They want to be able to get in a little friendly game, but they like to have this game controlled. Your approval of House Bill 2540 and the proposed amendments would help us address a social and economic problem of mutually concern to all of us. The problem we have when we bring this before legislature or anyone is credibility. As an owner, people think, I want to be able to set up a casino in my place and rake in the money from gambling. That's not it. The social gaming law allows social games to be conducted in my place if, of course, the local government decides to license them and opts in on the program. But our problem is who do we allow to sit down there and do that? Now, I can say to myself, well, this guy looks all right, I'll let him sit down and deal. But then he's there for 10 minutes and decides he doesn't want to deal anymore. Someone else wants to deal. And so we get in people that we absolutely know nothing about that want to deal a game. And this happens not only in private establishments, but it happens in Elks clubs and the various service clubs throughout Oregon. And so we're at a dilemma as to whether we should allow that person to sit down there and gamble or not. And right now, under the present law, why we find ourselves in the dilemma of saying, well, should we or shouldn't we? And if we do, is this person smart enough that he's going to be a so-called card mechanic and fleece our customers, which we don't want him to do? But yet, the law is vague on what rights we have as far as setting a person down. So really all we're asking for, and I hope if I get any point across today, is we're asking for the right to control what can go on in our establishment. Now today I brought with me, some people think this has been a Newport problem. It's not a Newport, it happens all over the state. I think you've seen in the newspaper that every so often a certain town gets in trouble because they go a little bit too far. And it depends on how much time the various district attorneys have and to prosecute and to research it and to close this down or do this or do that. And is a case of the cities and counties throughout Oregon having a problem that they really don't know how to deal with. Well, today I brought with me Chief of Police Jim Rivers from the city of Newport, who was, I think, with me 6 years ago when we testified before Governor Attia. And he's been close to the problem, and I brought him along in case you'd have any questions as far as he was concerned or the city is concerned on the control and what we're asking for. Thank you.
Fine. Would you like to make a statement?
Sure. Just to reiterate the control
situation. Just for the record, give us your
My name is Jim Rivers. I'm the Chief of Police in the city of Newport.
Thank you.
I might just take a brief amount of your time to show you that we have 15 licensed gambling tables in the city of Newport, socialized gambling tables in 8 separate establishments at this time. Anyone, literally anyone, can come into those 15 tables and start a game. They don't have to abide by any rules that are written or any type of licensing or any type of acknowledgement whatsoever. They're not required by any ordinance or any state statute to identify themselves to the owner of that establishment. What this House bill would do for us would be able to control those people and license them. If you come to the city of Newport, and I hope that you do, you're going to pay for the same for a bowl of clam chowder in Newport that you pay in Salem. You may pay a few cents more for gasoline in Newport, but it costs us a little more to get it there. We don't like to rip off our tourist trade, and we are a tourist town. And we're doing that with our socialized gambling at present because we have no way of controlling it. It is very possible for high rollers to come through to be able to rip off our tourists. What the ORBA and the other groups are asking for is some way of controlling that.
Sheriff Rivers, I'm wondering, is there a particular reason why there aren't any local city ordinances to control that?
The city of Newport has a socialized gambling ordinance. It is my understanding, and I do not come today before you as an expert in causing those ordinances to occur. Traditionally, the cities have not been allowed, nor counties have been allowed, to form those types of rules. I would suspect it would be possible for the city to say we're going to license dealers, but under the statute the way it's written now, you can't have dealers. But I'm telling you as I sit here that there is dealers that are working in some of the establishments not only in Newport but in other cities having socialized ordinances, socialized gaming ordinances in the state. Under the state statute the way it's written now, you cannot have a quote dealer.
Excuse my ignorance, but I need to understand, when somebody comes in and has a, you mentioned the tables, the 15 tables, license tables, what does it take to get that license?
They pay $500 to the city of Newport and make application.
It's a business license to have that?
Yes.
Okay. And then you said that anybody can walk in and deal at that?
Yes.
And how does that rip off the tourists?
What it means basically is that, let's use an example of the four of us. I want to go into an establishment and play some cards, some blackjack or poker. I'm a high roller from Reno, and I want to come in and I'll deal the game. And we'll make up our own rules. You know, if I know how to manipulate the cards, I'm going to manipulate the cards on you, and there's nobody keeping me from doing that. There's no one that is in charge of that table to be able to correct any mistakes that are made or manipulating that's going on.
Okay. Mr. Chair. The problem has been the cities, some of them have tried to write ordinances to control these, but they've ran into problems with the basic law because it gets into such things as house rules and statutes and so on that the Attorney General has said that they can't get into. So really we're just asking for the right to sit a person down there and control that game so that everybody gets a fair deal.
Mr. Chair.
Person Bowman.
I guess the question that occurred to me, we had testimony on a previous day about bingo operations, and they have some problems, and testimony today. It sounds to me that a really straightforward way of dealing with something that's a relatively small industry, if you want to call it, or a small business interest, just started, I assume, kind of experimentally or whatever, anyway, 15 tables, and now it's growing into, my gosh, you know, you guys have to take a day off work and come to Salem, and we're going to try to scramble around and fine-tune this, and it's going to involve the police and the DAs and card sharks and, as you say, public perception and a degree of trust. I really don't see where the public policy of allowing social gaming at this point is furthering any policy interest of the state or of your business at all. And it sounds to me that the most direct and straightforward way of dealing with the situation would be to take the social games out. Then you can deal with the customers who come in who are in Newport. I'm sure they don't go to Newport to play cards. If they do, I would think that you'd be running into exactly the same kind of problems that you're concerned about here on a scale that I don't think we're going to be able to regulate with fine-tuning. And I would think that a bright line here would be much more useful. And unfortunately, I realize this is a stick-in-the-mud commentary for you to hear from a member of the panel. But I think that the bright line here that we ought to consider drawing is just not to have this. And to draw the line now, while there are 15 tables, and the problems are relatively small, instead of waiting until we have people who are looking for other people on the streets of Newport to pay gambling debts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bauman, if I might address that. This particular amendment here would put a limit on the amount of tables that could be allowed in any given establishment. That's one of the concerns that the Attorney General had. Secondly, if we didn't have a social gaming ordinance, people really couldn't get together in their home and have a friendly poker game. Is this what we want?
Couldn't get together in their home and have a friendly poker game?
No.
I guess I don't understand that.
That's one of the things that started it initially, was the social gaming law, so that they can.
I guess now I just have a different reaction to people getting to whatever the law would require to allowing people to get together in their homes and have a friendly game than the broader public aspects. Although maybe, and I remember cases in Portland, and we've got somebody here from the Portland District Attorney's Office, although he's here on something else. But I do remember cases in Portland where people would put together clubs in their basements and have really
then it becomes a question of friendly or not. I understand.
I don't think that's the kind of a public policy that I really want to sit here and promote either. And those are my concerns. If you are telling me that this is a major moneymaker, a major draw, a major recreational activity, but actually it sounds like it's a headache.
Well, I guess I would like to respond, if I might, to that. Is I want you to understand that I come here today with mixed emotions. Having served several years in law enforcement, I guess I would prefer to see gambling go away also. My experience is that it isn't going to go away. It is an attraction in Newport. I want you to know that we have other mighty fine and rewarding attractions other than socialized gambling. But there is a particular portion of the community that feels that it is an attraction to draw tourists to Newport, and in fact is advertised as much. I guess the problem that I have is that it is a state statute. Our city has chosen to make it a ordinance, and the only way that the city has an ability to control that at this particular point would be for a change in the statute to allow them to do that. I want you to also understand, so that you know, that I am coming from both sides of the fence, that I am sure that Sheriff Brooks is still here. I know that the Sheriff's Association has come out against this amendment, and I am only making the assumption at this point that the Chiefs Association probably will. I don't know what type of voting, what type of percentage goes either way, but I know that the chiefs that I've talked to that have socialized gambling in their cities have some major concerns over the ability to control it.
Chairman, could I ask you a couple of questions? I take it this really relates towards blackjack, does it not? This is the game that you're primarily concerned with?
Mr. Chair, no, this does not. It would relate to blackjack, poker, and any game other than the lottery.
And this would allow you to employ a dealer?
I don't like the term dealer. This would be more of a game monitor. Okay. He'd be dealing the cards, yes, but he does not, in the terms... In the terms of of dealer, when you think of dealer, that person's banking the game.
Okay, let me ask you a further question. In blackjack, would you have a house dealer?
No, he would be a monitor. The dealer would be whoever puts up the money, he would deal for him. That's the way it's done.
So the deal would pass?
Pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How would it pass? If someone getting 21, the deal would pass to him?
Right. Or pass to the left. To address Representative Baum's question, Mr. Chair, it isn't a big money maker, but the fact is it's there and it's another activity, and the tourists seem to want it, and the clubs seem to want it, and although it does pose some headaches for us, it's the demand is there. Now, I don't really know why back in 1970 that the social gaming ordinance was passed, other than to allow such things as people to get together and have a game of chance if they wanted to among themselves.
I can remember some of the discussion on this bill last session, and part of the conclusion, I guess, in my mind was that it's a little bit like drinking. I don't, it's unfortunate that the state's in the business of that, but it is, and it's, some of the vices that we carry around, it goes all the way through the marijuana laws and that sort of thing as well. If